Congress will be obligated to provide the necessary funding to operate the Indian Health Service and the tribal health care system.
An Indian health bill 2 decades in the making. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 23rd of March. Good evening, I'm Laurie Townsend. Also tonight, celebrating a slice of Sitka history with an elaborate work of art that took on a life of its own.
I'm very much a part of it. We're very actively involved. And now, well, it's on its own. It's going to do just fine.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Association of Alaska School Boards, working with school districts statewide to bring innovation to classrooms through digital learning for the 21st century. Information at aasb.org. And by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
A charter plane with 3 passengers aboard crashed at the Homer Airport this afternoon. All passengers were safely removed from the wreckage, according to Alaska State Trooper spokeswoman Megan Peters. Peters says the plane, a fixed-wing Cessna 206, operated by Homer Air, was carrying 1 male pilot and 2 female passengers when it crashed on approach to the runway.
It was reported to us that the plane fell out of the sky. I can't elaborate on that because that's the wording that I was given with no explanation behind it. One person was transported to the hospital. It appears that they were all non-life-threatening injuries. However, we're not doctors, so that's not really a medically sound opinion.
According to a trooper report, the pilot was uninjured while the passengers sustained minor injuries, including bumps, bruises, and abrasions. All 3 have been transported to South Peninsula Hospital for treatment and observation. Homer Airport employee Lucy Kunkler says the airport has reopened, even though the wreckage of the plane is still being investigated at the crash site, about 150 yards from the end of the runway. When President Obama signed the health care bill into law today, he reauthorized the Indian Health Care Improvement Act, something that hadn't been done in 2 decades. The reauthorization was rolled into the broader health care package passed by the Senate and House. The president's Health and Human Services Secretary, Kathleen Sebelius, says it's been a long time coming.
We need to live up to these historic commitments, which frankly have been left on the wayside, recognize that the health disparities in Indian country are quite shocking.
Sebelius says among the changes the White House hopes to make is elevating the job of running the Indian Health Service from an agency director to an assistant secretary. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski has worked to update the Indian Health Care Act since she went to Washington 8 years ago. She says the fact that the act has now been permanently reauthorized gives it more solid footing and finally improves it.
Think about how healthcare has changed since the last time we had the healthcare reauthorization. We really had no provisions in the Indian Healthcare Act as it related to behavioral health. We didn't have anything in there as it related to long-term care. So I think what permanent authorization means is that we will take it up again as we see changes.
As a Republican, Murkowski voted against the health care bill President Obama signed into law today. That put her in the position of voting against the Indian health care reauthorization she had advocated. Andy Tuber is the chairman and president of the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. He says funds for behavioral health programs are crucial, as are funds for fetal alcohol spectrum disorders and domestic violence prevention. He says the Obama administration seems to realize there's been a problem with IHS contract support funding. Tuber says it's one of the only agencies that has been historically underfunded for the services they provide.
The fact that this is taking place now is a signal that we're going to have more parity among those other agencies in delivering health care to the constituents that we serve on the Alaska Native Health side and with Indian Health Service.
Tuber is also the president of the Kodiak Native Association. He says there is a serious backlog of health facility construction projects in rural Alaska that may now get funding.
I can tell you that there are, approaching $100 million worth of backlog facilities in rural Alaska that need construction funds and need support in order to be built.
Tuber says these include rural sanitation, healthcare facilities, as well as transportation infrastructure. Rural healthcare providers say the reauthorization funds could have a major impact for remote communities. For member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson has more.
Gene Peltola is president and CEO of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation, based in Bethel. For years, he's been managing health care in one of the poorest and most remote corners of the country. He says passage of the IHS reauthorization is a milestone in Native health care.
We've been battling for over 10 years now to try to get reauthorization of the Indian Health Care Improvement Act.
Peltola says the Reauthorization Act reaffirms the federal government's trust responsibility to provide health care to Native Americans.
It's real significant because without reauthorization, basically, we were dependent upon the good faith of the current administration or the administration that was in office and Congress to appropriate the funds.
The act won't erase decades of politics surrounding Native health care funding, but the reauthorization will bolster efforts by Native health care proponents to leverage federal funding in the future.
Congress will be obligated to provide the necessary funding to operate the Indian Health Service and the tribal health care system.
The reauthorization will also expand services that IHS can provide. Most notably, Congress, through Indian Health Services, can fund long-term health care facilities for elders and seniors. That's something that IHS could never do in the past, and that's part of the reason there are no assisted living centers in remote parts of the state. YKHC has for years been planning on building a senior center in Bethel so that elders don't have to relocate to Anchorage for care. They have already secured half the funding for the project, and now they're hopeful that the federal government may help pick up the $8 million still needed for construction. YKHC says that will also save the state of Alaska money because elders cared for under IHS will not need state Medicaid. The new law will also allow for IHS to broaden funding for behavioral health, professional recruitment and training in rural areas, and it frees up funds for IHS providers to modernize their services. YKHC is still sorting through the thousands of pages in the bill to see what other effects the final version will have on Native health care. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, researching the changing ice conditions on the Tanana River.
It is dangerous. It is unpredictable. And extreme caution should be taken.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years. And by Pennair, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pennair.com.
After 58 years, a shipwreck just outside of Juneau's Auk Bay has piqued the interest of federal and state authorities. Fuel oil may be leaking from the Princess Kathleen, a steamship that ran aground and sank at Point Lena. Now it may be a race against time to empty the underwater tanks before there's a catastrophic spill. KTOO's Matt Miller recently traveled out to the site and has this story.
This is a unique project, but working on submerged wrecks is not an uncommon project for us. This is unique because of its location, the sensitivity of the historic wreck, and obviously the environmental area.
Jim Butler is with Global Offshore Diving and Salvage, the firm hired to examine the ship. They're the ones operating the diving support vessel and lightering barge positioned just above the wreck at Point Lena.
And one of the things we're very making sure we're focusing on is we're not disturbing the historical part of the wreck.
As part of the Princess Kathleen's last run of the cruise ship season in 1952, a crewman allowed the vessel to swerve too close to the shoreline and run up on the rocks. Fortunately, passengers and crew were able to safely evacuate the vessel, but the wounds that the vessel suffered were mortal. It later slipped backward under the waves, resting on its port side on an incline in roughly 100 feet of water. The wreck has been a nearshore favorite of scuba divers for decades. Its listing as a historically significant site is even noted in planning documents for what later became NOAA's Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute. But oddly, there doesn't appear to be any mention in the environmental impact statement about the potential of 150,000 gallons of fuel just offshore.
That was not, you know, part of our agency knowledge at that time. That is the fact. We didn't really understand the potential for oil pollution posed by the vessel.
Phil Mundy, director of the Institute, says they noticed a sheen offshore of the just-completed facility 3 years ago.
The sheen occurs on a monthly, if not weekly, basis. It's not regular in its pattern. Sometimes it's there and sometimes it's not. But we've seen it multiple times since we moved in here.
Mundy says the source was unclear. Was it left over from construction of the lab, another nearby accidental discharge, or was it the wreck?
You know, when do you look? Well, you hope you look before there's a big failure.
That's Captain Melissa Burke, head of the Coast Guard for Southeast Alaska and the Federal On-Scene Coordinator. Part of her answer to a question about why now, after the wreck has been virtually ignored for half a century.
And our concern, of course, is we don't want to have a catastrophic release. We don't want to see what has happened in other parts of the country, which is at some point a tank fails or many tanks fail, and bunker oil is all over the place. It affects wildlife. It's really just a disaster.
The Coast Guard and State Department of Environmental Conservation have created a unified command, sharing responsibility for directing the investigation and any possible cleanup, similar to what was done during the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Expenses paid out of the oil spill liability trust fund, a post-Exxon Valdez established account of oil taxes and penalties collected from spillers.
We have a frightening amount of money at our disposal. We're obviously trying to do our best job to be stewards, but it's expensive to remove oil and even to do these assessments. I'm trying to think of how much money we've spent to date. Do we know how much?
About $1 million so far, according to Burt later. As part of the inspection, divers will drill into the fuel tanks, probe for any oil, and then quickly plug the holes. A decision could be made soon whether to remove the oil, and Butler says that operation could take weeks.
Because this oil is so viscous and heavy, they'll actually insert in some locations a heating element, and like a heat exchanger, and will circulate very warm water through that, and it brings the oil up to pumping temperature, and we just start pumping.
One area of potential concern is any accidental leak. Butler points to a containment boom already positioned just north of the barge and dive support vessel. Located several hundred feet south is the seawater intake used by both the NOAA lab and the new University of Alaska Fairbanks School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences building. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
A group of Fairbanks researchers were in the village of Tanana last week as part of an ice travel safety study. University of Alaska Fairbanks professors Knut Keeland and Bill Snyder have been leading the National Science Foundation project since 2004. Snyder says the effort is aimed at understanding dangerous ice on the Tanana River.
We recognize the Tanana River is a dangerous river, and the idea is for local people to take us to places that they see in the course of their daily work to bring their experience with the place, and scientists to bring their background to try to figure out what we could find out about these conditions.
Snyder says scientists are keying off local knowledge of the river to track open holes and thin ice. He says the project has been focused around Fairbanks, but has just recently expanded downriver to the village of Tanana. Project consultant Sam Dementif of Fairbanks has traveled interior rivers from Ruby to Fairbanks since the 1940s. Dementif credits some of the increase in dangerous ice conditions to a warmer climate.
Generally, you know, there's a real difference in the climate from the 40s and 50s and 60s to today. You know, back then there used to be what was referred to as cold snaps, or 10 days to 2 weeks of minus 30 to minus 50 or colder. The ice back then would be frozen solid. It would be 3 to 4 feet deep. But now you can encounter some dangerous areas.
Dementev says they've also observed rapidly shifting areas of open water and weak ice unrelated to air temperature. Researchers believe some of the inconsistent activity may be caused by shifts in underlying currents and springs that can contribute warmer water to the river. Snyder says the takeaway from the study is pretty straightforward.
It's a very active river, and the message for the general public is that it is dangerous, that it is unpredictable, and that extreme caution should be taken.
The researchers have logged GPS coordinates of dangerous areas and plan to develop an ice safety manual for river travelers.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Tlingit attorney Liz Medicine Crow works for the Native Policy Center at the First Alaskans Institute in Anchorage. Medicine Crow comes from a family where advanced education has always been considered important, and women in her family have made academic history more than once. Her sister was the first Tlingit woman to graduate from MIT, and her grandmother was one of the first Haida women to get a bachelor's degree in the 1930s. As part of our continuing series on Native education in South Central Alaska, Liz Medicine Crow tells us of her life in the small southeast village of Cake before moving to Juneau and then the East Coast for college. She ended up at Bates College in Maine and says it was an eye-opening experience.
And it allowed me to really start understanding my home better, my connection to my home, and who I was. And so those 2 years at Bates were really educational for me in terms of that quality of life and link back to my community.
That's so interesting because oftentimes we hear that a lot of young people have so much trouble because they've left their home and try to go somewhere for education outside of their support network and just can't make it.
Yeah.
Why do you think that was different for you?
I think it was different for me because of my roots in my community and my village, because of my grandparents and my ancestors, and because of my mother and my father, who were really committed to ensuring that my sister and I had the best opportunities for education that we could. And the reason that we left Cake and moved to Juneau was because my sister was just a genius and was she was just doing fantastically in terms of her schoolwork, especially math. So they wanted to give her opportunities in Juneau.
This seems really key that even though you were so far away and your sister all the way to the East Coast for education, and yet you still had that strength from your family. How did your parents and your extended family sort of reach their arms that far across the country to make sure that you still felt strong and supported through all that?
Well, I think it started from the moment we were born. I think that they gave us that groundwork, that foundation, long before that was even in sight. Those places that far away from home were even in sight. Now, that doesn't mean it wasn't difficult. I'll tell you a really funny story. I was, I think, starting my sophomore year at Bates. Really, really homesick. I was thinking I was going to drop out. I called my nan, my grandma, because her and I were so close, I figured she would hear how sad I was and she would tell me, go ahead, come home now. So I called her and I said, hi, nan. And she said, oh, I was just praying about you. I'm just so proud of you for what you're doing. And she told me about what happened with her. She graduated from Sheldon Jackson and wanted to go to Arizona with some friends to get a nursing degree. Well, her stepfather and the superintendent of the school were able to get her a scholarship, a four-year scholarship to a teacher's college in Asheville, North Carolina. So in 1935, she traveled from Southeast Alaska by herself across the country to North Carolina, where she had to stay for 4 years, couldn't come home. And during that time, she lost a lot of her brothers and her stepfather to tuberculosis. But she stayed all the way through and she graduated. And I think she might have been one of the first Haida women with a Bachelor of Science degree. And she graduated from the Asheville Normal Teachers College. Well, when I called her and was, you know, wanting her to tell me it was okay to drop out, that's not what she said.
Instead, you found out why you needed to stay.
Yeah, you know, but it wasn't anything that anyone else listening would have even understood in terms of how it happened, because I just said, "Hi, Nan, it's me." And she said, "Oh, I was just praying for you, and I was thinking about you and how proud I am that you're sticking it out. And, you know, when I was at school, I was there for 4 years all by myself and I could never come home. And it just makes me so proud that you're there."
So she knew exactly mm-hmm. what you needed without really even directly addressing it.
Exactly, exactly. So she asked me, "What's going on?" I said, "Nothing." "I just wanted to hear your voice."
"I'll go back to schoolwork now."
Exactly.
Someone said to me recently that culture belongs to the living, which is a very simple statement, but I really had to think about that for quite a while, because there's a lot of times people bemoan, "Oh, we're losing this and we're losing that." But that statement, when I thought about it, I realized that it means youth has to keep interpreting what culture is mm-hmm. so that it stays alive and relevant. Is it more difficult now, or has it always been the same struggle?
You know, I don't know. I think that's how we were raised. It's about moving forward in your life and about carrying your culture forward. Being Alaska Native doesn't just mean that I receive benefits from being Alaska Native. For me, the primary responsibility and obligation about being Alaska Native is to my community. To me, it's about you have a role, you have responsibility, you have obligations, you take care of those things the best that you can. One of them is get an education. The other is know who you are. Carry on your cultural values. Learn your language if you can. Help others. Bring it back home. And I think it was Oscar Coagley. My mother used to work at Sheldon Jackson as a special liaison to the president. And Oscar was there, and he was doing a presentation, and I was visiting my mom, so I went to listen to him. And he said that if all you do is copy what has been done in the past, then you're practicing a dead art, because you have a responsibility to create new things and to move the culture and the people forward.
Liz Medicine Crow works for the First Alaskans Native Policy Center in Anchorage. Pictures and more stories on Native education are at our website, aprn.org. Sitka National Historical Park officially turns 100 today, but events honoring the milestone got underway this past weekend. While the events are being billed as a birthday celebration, the park commemorates some sensitive history. KCAW's Ed Ronco has the story.
That's a Kiksadi song in honor of the Tlingits who died during a canoe explosion just before the 1804 battle with Russians that took place at the park. It's used here with permission from Kiksadi elder Ray Wilson. The song on Saturday was part of a retracing of that battle aboard the Allen Marine boat St. Maria with history scholars Richard and Nora Dauenauer. The boat took passengers through Sitka Sound and just off the park's shore. After the boat docked, passengers walked into the park and to the site of the Kiksadi Fort. Kiksadi leader Ray Wilson told the crowd that it was a tough decision whether to share this history publicly. Wilson says in the grand scheme of Tlingit history, the events on the fort site are still fresh.
And it still hurts to talk about these things because it didn't happen that very long ago.
Oh, yeah. Sunday's events had a more festive tone, with the dedication of a raven's tail robe woven by Sitka artist Terry Rothkar. The robe is designed to tell the story of the park and includes representations of native tattoo patterns, wolf moss, bull kelp, and national park symbols. Rothkar says usually one of these robes takes 1,000 hours to complete.
This one took 2,000 hours. Now, if it didn't have a story when I started, it would by the time I finished. That is the truth.
Rothkar says the raven's tail weaving technique goes back hundreds, maybe thousands of years. The robe revealed on Sunday was inspired by one Rothkar saw in 2007 at a museum in St. Petersburg, Russia. She visited that museum again in January, and through an interpreter, a guide at the museum shared a startling fact with Rothkar.
They were collected by the Russians in 1788 in Lituya Bay. They were from Lituya Bay. You could have blown me over with the feather. My totem family comes from Lituya Bay. So many of you have connections with Lituya Bay. So many. Fishermen, you guys take cover in Lituya Bay. I mean, it's still a place we have a continuing relationship with today. So this is pretty huge for me.
A continuing relationship might be the best way to describe Rothkar's experience in weaving the robe over the last 2 years.
I'm very much a part of it. We're very actively involved. And now, well, it's on its own. It's going to do just fine.
And the more you listen to Rothkar, the more you get the impression that she sounds almost like a mother talking about her child.
And a 2-year gestation period, that can't be good. Absolutely. Yeah, it is. Because I can't take credit for all of the genes in there, but, you know, it does come from someplace, and it's very much everybody's now.
In many ways, the whole weekend became a tapestry of many stories and many cultures who have found themselves woven together over the last 100 years. That much was clear to Nancy Yaw Davis, who was born and raised in Sitka, left after graduating high school in 1954, and returned just last year. She says events like the robe dedication make her proud to live in Sitka.
It's absolutely awesome. I was profoundly touched by this series of events, and we've only gotten started. Just think what this whole year could say about this community and about our human connections to its history and its prehistory and its present, and how we can be a part of shaping what happens next. And I feel connected to this town like I'm kind of stunned and overwhelmed at this point.
The commemoration of the park's 100th birthday continues throughout the year. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Aaron Selbig in Homer, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Matt Miller in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ed Ronco in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. And by BP, unlocking Alaska's resource potential. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.